training at about 50 locations a year. We train in the fall semester from September to November and the spring semester January to March. We have always one Master Gardener program behind bars. Sometimes we have two, but it alternates. Sometimes the women program picks it up. Sometimes the minimum security at Iowa City, home of the University of Iowa, picks it up. And we're training about 300 to 350 new Master Gardeners per year. I did learn the hard way, and I would tell Mike Raup that he's probably learned this also, that when you're in a Master Gardener program behind bars, don't ask why they are there. It stops the conversation. You're having this nice conversation with somebody who seems like a perfectly normal person, and you ask the logical question, what are you in for? I killed a guy. I don't know how you respond to that. That's So I've learned, don't ask. If you're in the prison, don't ask why they're there. We cover 15 subject matter areas. 9 of those are taught by the distance education program that I just described. The other 6 are taught in face-to-face. So it's not entirely looking at a TV screen. There are local presentations, and all Iowa Master Gardeners come to Saturday class on campus, a laboratory experience that's on campus. This list looks just like everybody else. You see the things that are taught by distance education using experts, staff, and faculty from campus. The face-to-face classes can be taught by campus staff. We send campus staff out to do, maybe a dozen every semester. We're helping counties with local, with statewide talent. Otherwise, either the county directors teach it themselves, or they find a local person. It looks like there are lots of face-to-face sessions, but integrated pest management, pesticides, and weeds are all taught as one unit. They're separate chapters in the book, but they're all taught as one unit. So there are only 4 nights of face-to-face and 7 nights of distance education. And that campus class on the campus experience is a laboratory experience where every Master Gardener comes to campus either 2 Saturdays in the fall or 2 Saturdays in the spring semester, where they cover another laboratory exercise in botany, soils, entomology, and plant pathology. So the distance education is half of the entomology lesson. The class on campus is the other half of it. And they bring their workbooks and they bring their schedules, and we run them around to 3 different buildings, and this takes lots of explanation. How do I get to campus? Where do I park? How do I find the building? So we give them lots of maps and advanced training, and then we stand out on the street corner in February, and when you see a car driving up real slowly without a town license plates, you point and say, over there. So we get them on campus for this experience, and they're busy. They're running around all day from campus. They move through 3 different buildings. Every 40 minutes, they're moving to another class experience. They're doing 2 different soils labs. They do 2 different botany labs. They're doing 2 entomology labs, and then they're doing 1 huge plant pathology lab, which is how it's set up. And this is Dr. Laura Jesse teaching the entomology lab in one of our recent class on campuses experiences. We use a lot of graduate students to teach these different courses, and the Master Gardeners love it. These, as you'll see, most Master Gardeners are my age, or just slightly younger, and they meet these college kids, and they just love the experience of rubbing elbows with these students who have so much enthusiasm for their information that they will come to campus on a Saturday to teach in exchange for $100. Who knows, you could get graduate students to work that hard for $100. So the entomology instruction is 1.5 hours on distance education using a PowerPoint presentation, and 40 minutes on a laboratory exercise on class, and 40 minutes in a lecture on class that reinforces many of the things you've already heard about this morning. I don't spend a lot of time on taxonomy anymore. I learned that lesson. They don't care where the spiracles are located. They don't care how to pronounce the plural of trachea. But we still talk a lot about identification, growth and development, mouth parts, and behavior. The class on campus lab emphasizes those insect orders, the mouth parts, and the impacts, including damage symptoms that they might have, a look at the insect relatives that are there as well. And then when they come to my session on the, which is ornamentals, this is where I do cover the top 10 insects that are found on trees and shrubs in Iowa, and we go over each one of those insects in detail, and I very carefully use terms like instar and life cycle and mouth part and economic injury level. I use that vocabulary that they've heard in the 1.5-hour lecture in this 40-minute follow-up, just focusing on trees and shrubs. Insects on turf grass, vegetables, and fruits are covered in those chapters by the horticulturists who teach them. We did do this evaluation. We asked the instructors, the county coordinators, and the participants how this all works and feels for them. This was the part that my horticulture colleagues asked about how people accept it. Does it meet their needs? What are the benefits and challenges of using the distance education system? We asked 188 master gardeners. We did this while they were on class on campus. We feed them when they're there on Saturday. They're locked into a room to get their lunch, and they don't get out until they turn in a survey. So we got really good response rate on this. The program is coordinated in the counties by either a county director, a volunteer, an office assistant, or a paid horticulturist. We did get good response from those other people as well. This is a study that we invented on a Friday night before class on campus started on Saturday. We cut plastic tubing into foot-long pieces. They pour in a measured amount of soil. We give them a one-by-one stick, and they pound on the soil in one tube as hard as they can, and then they pour in water and measure the time it takes it to go through. And they learn a lot about compaction and soil airspace during that experiment. So our survey was 14 questions with some open-ended and some Likert questions, and it took them 10 to 15 minutes, and pretty typical survey. What we found out is what you kind of look gather looking around the room. Our classes are a little more weighted toward females than males. Most of them are 43 to 64 years old, some younger, some older. We do take teenagers in the Master Gardener program, but we try to discourage them because when they come to the class on campus, they are the ones who end up cutting themselves with the razor blades in the botany lab. They do rate the information as very useful to them, and they like the horticultural knowledge that they gain out of the entire Master Gardener's experience. This wasn't just entomology, this was the entire program. When you ask them, how do you like to learn, of course they like face-to-face. They like Donald Lewis to drive 3 hours in a car to meet with 12 of them for 3 hours on a Tuesday night. But 22% said, yeah, the webcast is pretty good. That's a pretty good substitute. But they really do want you there. It's just we can't do that for all the ones that are there. So we asked the coordinators, how is it for you, those of you who are running it? And they think it's very valuable information, and they love Adobe Connect. And I'll show you in a little bit why they do. They love it because they don't have to travel, because the campus faculty and staff are doing the instruction, it's easily accessible, and they stay in their county extension office. They don't have to go to another facility. And of course, Adobe Connect archives these as well. What they don't like is the audio breaks up every once in a while. They don't really like the chat, and they feel like they need more technology support, but then who doesn't? They are accepting of it. It does work for us. I wouldn't say that it was going to work for everybody, but it is the most effective system that we have found. And if you think you're doing Master Gardener training just because you're an entomologist and you're not impacting lives, I want to finish with this slide. One of our Master Gardeners died suddenly, unexpectedly, and the family had the Master Gardener logo engraved on her tombstone. That's how important we are. Thank you.
I want to change gears a bit and talk about the soybean aphid as a pest in a different agricultural system. By pest, I refer to the damage they cause indirectly as vectors of plant viruses. So Wisconsin is the leading state in terms of snap bean production. While a portion of beans produced go to fresh market, the majority are processed. By processed, I mean frozen or canned. A current problem the snap bean industry has been faced with is a disease resulting in what we call chocolate pod. Here in the photo, you can see the necrosis and the curled C-shaped form of the pod, which makes it difficult to process the bean. Growers wanted to know what was causing this chocolate pod symptoms. So German and others in the department conducted a virus survey in 2003 across the state to try to identify the causal agents. Two viruses, alfalfa mosaic virus and cucumber mosaic viruses, were commonly detected in snap bean in that year. Virus incidence, or the percent of infected plants, is divided by region. Here you can see New Richmond, Oconto, Central Sands, and South Central, as well as Door County. Here you can see also that the incidence of CMV is much higher than that of AMV across all regions. And virus infection was greatest in the south central region. To give a brief background on AMV and CMV, they both are RNA viruses with multiple strains. They can infect a broad range of plant species. Over 200 plant species are susceptible to AMV. Over 700 plant species are susceptible to CMV. The current literature reports a virus complex or combination of these viruses that cause this chocolate pod symptom. They even suggest the possibility of a third virus. But most importantly, they are transmitted by aphids in a non-persistent manner, meaning they can immediately pick up or acquire the virus and without a latent period, immediately transmit. So listed in red are common aphid pest species that are capable vectors of at least one of these two viruses. Of these listed, the only recent introduction to the Wisconsin snap bean has been soybean aphid. So we decided to look at snap bean production since the arrival of the soybean aphid, and we do see a trend. Here, on the y-axis corresponding to the bar graph is Wisconsin snap bean yield in tons per acre. This is an average. On the opposite y-axis we see, which corresponds to the line, is the average soybean aphid populations. Although this correlation was not statistically significant, we just don't have enough years, we still were wondering what possible role, if any, the soybean aphid might be playing in commercial bean. And what made us think this is because you start to see on high aphid years decreases in snap bean production. So in order to get at this question, we first need to understand what causes a virus epidemic. Virus epidemics are not consistent. They don't happen every single year, generally, and they tend to go in hot spots in parts of one state and not the other. So I put together a roadmap to put in perspective the necessary chance events that need to occur to cause an epidemic. First, aphids need to visit snap bean. What aphids do visit snap bean? Also, aphids need to be able to acquire and transmit viruses that are common in snap bean, either from plant to plant, as you see here, or through introductions into the field from a natural source of inoculum. So we also need to identify where these sources of inoculum exist in the environment. And last, aphids must visit these forage plants to acquire a virus and transmit to the field. So now I'm going to walk through each step to look at the vector capability of soybean aphid in each of these events. So first, the step is to identify all the possible vectors. Who visits snap bean? So we suspect that the soybean aphid does visit snap bean. So we set out to monitor aphid flight activity in 15 snap bean fields for two consecutive years. We used a 3-inch by 3-inch Gladware sandwich container filled with 50% propylene glycol, 50% water, and placed it just inside the edge of the snap bean field within 5 meters, the second within at a 50 meters away from the edge, and then the third at 100 meters away from the edge. We changed these traps on a weekly basis, starting in the beginning of June until the very end of August. So all future flight graphs that I will be showing will take the same format. I've categorized on the x-axis throughout the season. It's divided by week and grouped by month and shaded in gray here. Soybean aphid color will always be in blue, and on the y-axis is the total alate abundance caught for all traps and for all fields for that particular week. So in 2006, we saw that the soybean aphid does visit snap bean with peak abundances in early August, late July, also a smaller less active flight in mid-July. In 2007, we see only one peak flight occurring earlier than in 2006, at the end of July. Notice the difference in trap counts in 2006 compared to 2007. I had the same number of water pan traps for both years. We can roughly see a fourfold difference. When we look at the other aphid species shown in magenta, we do not see similar patterns. In 2006, peak flight occurred early mid-July, which comprised mostly of the pea aphid. And in 2007, peak flight coincided with soybean aphid flight, and that composed mostly of Rapallisiphon matus, or the cornleaf aphid. What is interesting is that we do not see an increase in virus infection until after these late July, August peaks.